Remember the good old days before Microsoft Word had autosave? You'd type up some important document and then your computer would freeze and you'd lose hours of work just because you forgot to hit save? Well, that's what it's like going online without ExpressVPN. Every time you're connected to an unencrypted network, whether it's in an airport, a hotel, a cafe, or anywhere, your online data is not secure. Any person on that same network who knows what they're doing can gain access to your personal data. Bank logins, credit card details, passwords, all the stuff you don't want people seeing. Unfortunately, hacking has become much easier than it used to be. People don't even have to be exceptionally skilled to do it, and there's a lot of money to be made by selling your information on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. It's incredibly easy to use. Once the app is running, you literally click one button to get protected. And it works on your phone, laptop, tablet, and more, so you can stay protected on the go. I've been using ExpressVPN for a little while now, and I can rest easy knowing my info is safe and secure. I've heard horror stories of people who've been hacked, and it sounds like a massive pain to try to get any resolution in the aftermath, so I am not interested in finding out what that process is like. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/film.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, June 14th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the newest Pixar film, Inside Out 2. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editors Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And BJ Colangelo.
I can't stop crying.
Oh, no.
Yes, lots of emotions will be discussed in today's episode. All right, guys, let's kick things off here with some general sort of spoiler-free thoughts about the film. BJ, since you started off so hot for us, what did you make
of that? I really, really liked this movie. Obviously, the comparisons to the first movie are going to be inevitable. I'm waffling between, you know, how much I prefer the first one to this one, because it's very hard to, you know, distance myself from just being blown away by the first one. But I like, this is the movie that I wanted this to be. If I was going to get an Inside Out sequel, which I didn't need, I'm glad that this is the one I got. I feel very similarly to how I feel about like Toy Story 2 with this movie, that like I didn't need this, but I'm glad that it's here and I really like it and I cried like a big baby. So, you know, mission accomplished.
Brad, what about you?
Yeah, I really like this one a lot too. You know, it treads some familiar territory of the first one, and like BJ said, the comparisons are inevitable, and it doesn't quite measure up, because Inside Out did something that, you know, no other movie like this had really done before, and it really pulled it at the heartstrings in a beautiful way. And this one does the same thing with some variations and with some new characters, but I really liked what it did. And I think that as a sequel, it works and turns this really into a great franchise for kids to grow up with. You know, there's some kids who probably grew up watching the original Inside Out who are feeling some of these complicated feelings as they grow up. And, you know, there'll be new generations of kids that get to experience this too. And the way that it breaks down such complex things and really digs into stuff that can be hard to, you know, explain to kids is so lovely. And it's funny. It's charming. You know, the animation is incredible. You can really see some of the cool improvements they made from the first one. And so, yeah, I really liked it a lot. In fact, one thing I want to say, because like this really bugged me. I don't mean to call out this specific critic, and I won't even mention them by name, but the headline said something like "all brains and no heart." And all I could think of was the line from Jerry Maguire was "no heart, no heart. I'm all heart, motherfucker."
Oh, that's funny. I'll steal a line from Chris Evangelista, who spoke a little bit about the sequel on an episode of the podcast earlier this week. He said that the novelty had kind of worn off. And I absolutely agree with that idea. Like, part of the magic of the first movie was being taken into Riley's head for the first time and learning the structure of how the mind works, right? And like being introduced to all these emotions and seeing the clever puns and all this stuff. And this movie tries to recreate some of that by like introducing new emotions, which you've seen all over the trailers and stuff. And it takes us into new parts of Riley's mind. But the very nature of returning to the setting means that some of the shine has kind of worn off. So I thought the movie was mostly effective and overall I enjoyed watching it. But yeah, to me, it just kind of feels like, yeah, a lesser than experience than watching the first movie. But like, ultimately, I kind of think that at the end of the day, I'm where BJ is, where like, I'm glad that it exists because it's almost like I wish that it could have been released as like one gigantic movie or something like that, you know, like or re-edited into like a weird, one of those weird Godfather edits or something where it's like 4 hours long or whatever. And it's just like one long story because I don't know, maybe something about like the almost 10-year wait between movies kind of, and the fact that the first film was so good, like built up my expectations that I was like expecting, you know, something equally amazing. And like, it's just real tough to live up to that first movie. So, all right, let's get into spoilers. Brad, was there anything that jumped out at you, I guess, that you couldn't say in your earlier section, any particular plot point that you wanted to dig into or anything like that?
No, but, you know, I mean, and BJ, I think, will have a lot more to speak to about this because she wrote a great personal essay that you can find on Slash Film, if not now, then shortly, whenever you're listening to this. But I really liked how they approached anxiety as an emotion and made it so that while anxiety can easily be seen as the antagonist in the movie, the character isn't like a straight up villain. And this is one thing that I read more about in The Art of Inside Out 2, where they really had to hone in on like the confrontation, the conflict that arose from having these new emotions arrive and what it meant for Joy and for Riley. And having anxiety be the driving force of this big change in Riley's life and also upheaving everything that like Joy has come to like find in the balance between her and the other emotions rather than you know, trying to control every single aspect, it brings up that dynamic again, but in a totally different way, and with the added level of like digging into what like anxiety does to us, especially when you're a kid and you don't fully understand and you're trying to figure out your identity. And like you can see like how they were able to like really hone in on that. And like Pixar, I love their development process because, like I said, in the art book, they talk about some of the emotions that didn't make it. And one of the ones that was seemingly would have been the antagonist if it wasn't anxiety was shame. But they couldn't really figure out how to make shame a fully 3D character that didn't feel like it was just an arch cartoon villain that like only wanted, you know, there to be something like bad happening and like really just like made problems for Riley without doing it from a place of care for Riley. But anxiety, like they really hone in on the fact that like everything she's doing because she's trying to protect Riley. She's trying to make sure that Riley has like the most promising future and gets what she wants. And so like she's trying to bring Joy to Riley's life in a completely different way than Joy is. And I really liked that dynamic and how like, you know, it made Joy feel helpless, but then it also allowed for that evolution that we see at the end of the movie. And while it's similar to like Joy again figuring out, oh, like there's room for all of us, it was you know, something that like anxiety had to learn as well as a character. So yeah, I really like that a lot about the story.
Yeah, I loved the anxiety character, and Maya Hawke just really killed it. In the gosh, voice
she's
role
so
there
good.
What do you think about that whole thing, PJ?
So yeah, the addition of anxiety, like really, they did such a good job with this. I mean, I've talked before on the show about how I used to be a teacher, but I don't usually talk about how I was a social emotional teacher. I literally taught children emotional competency and regulation. And so Inside Out was a huge, you know, tool that I used to use. And all I could think about is like how much better it would like our classes could have been if this movie existed at the same time. But the thing that I like the most about this movie, which is in ways that I think it's actually some parts of this movie I do think are better than the original. And I think it's when they are unafraid to say harsh realities out loud that we tend to shield children from. Like one of the big ones in the first Inside Out is when Sadness is talking about the importance of crying. And one of the things that she says is, crying helps me slow down and obsess over the weight of life's problems, which is like a very heavy thing to like put in a movie that children are going to be watching. But the two big ones for me in this is at one point, Joy says, I don't know how to stop anxiety. Maybe I can't. Maybe that's just what happens when you get older. You have less joy. Mm-hmm. And like, that sounds horrible, but it's so true. It's not to say that joy doesn't exist in your lives, but the older you get, the more like aware you become of how fucked up everything is, and you have so many more responsibilities, and you can't just like be a kid and hang out and everything's cool and have a good time. Like, there's so much bad stuff. So there is less joy in your life. There are more emotions taking control of your console. So I was like, that is a huge swing to put in this kids movie. That's great. Mm-hmm. But the big one was from anxiety, which is when she makes the confession of like, I'm sorry, I was just trying to protect her. And like, oh my God, like saying that out loud just made me almost start crying again. Because I think we all have such a misunderstanding of the functionality of anxiety in our lives. And that's what it is. It's an overreactive like response to, you know, traumatic stimuli. That's what anxiety is. And giving audiences, young and old, the ability to understand their own mind a little better, just fantastic. Like, unreal fantastic. And I don't know, I think that this movie's held back a little bit by the expectations of the original, because the second the second act of this movie, I think, is kind of a slog. I think the opening and the ending are like so good, but that middle section is just like meh and doesn't do it quite as well as the first. But I think the ending is just as good as the original film, and I actually think the opening is better than the original film.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I agree. Yep. I agree with your take on that second act, because the as soon as they leave the vault and they start wandering, there's not as much interesting like discovery of seeing things in the mind for the first time. You know, like it takes a little too long for them to like figure out what anxiety is doing with Riley's imagination and stuff like that. But then, yeah, once the third act starts kicking in, like you get some more of that creativity, and it feels, you know, kind of like the original again. But yeah, that second act it's missing something.
Yeah, and I think like it's because there's like the scene with the brainstorm, which I feel like the entire part of that is them building towards that one pun that isn't very good. Mm-hmm. But the imagination land being turned into essentially like existential worst case scenario land, that I thought was great, because that is absolutely what happens to your imagination. Like, you stop being a kid of like, what if I had, you know, a French fry garden and cloud land? Now I'm just going to think about how I'm going to die alone.
Yeah, I loved that. I think they break into like a pillow fort area where all of that is happening, and like the playing cards are used as cubicles and all that. Like, I love the design of that whole little area, and like, yeah, everything about that scene was really great. There's like some really funny little subtle jokes and stuff throughout up on the screens and stuff. If you're watching really closely, you can see a bunch of things that they don't really talk about in dialogue or whatever, but I thought it was great. Yeah, I totally agree with you guys, like especially that second act part. Like, you know, I just was disappointed in the pun heavy stuff this time around. That was so good in the first movie, and this time it just kind of feels like there are a lot of reject concepts that weren't quite good enough to make it into the first film, but they were just like, we'll use them here. Like the sarcasm bit was like okay, but like, you know, and the brainstorm thing, like you said, yeah, like it just kind of felt a little uninspired compared to
the first one for me too. Like the puns or the little, because I rewatched Inside Out 1 beforehand, and like there are so many little ones that I had forgotten about because they feel so like lived in. Like when they run into the cloud person and he's like, not now Jake, it's Cloud Town, like that like got me, and I was like, how did I forget that joke was there? That's great. But there's all these little bits like that, whereas in this movie it very much feels like, did you hear the pun we made? And that mm-hmm. makes it like less funny to me.
Yeah, I did love the part where they go to the vault though, and specifically the video game character that Riley had a crush on and that Disgust seems to be enamored by.
I'm so obsessed with that arc. I'm gonna tame what I said in our private work chat, but the fact that Disgust is the only person who is into the Lance Lashblade like video game character, that is proof positive that we are seeing the seeds of when you have that crush that you know you shouldn't have, like the embodiment of hear me out. And it's like, why is it the ghoul from Fallout? Like, why is that what you're into? But Disgust is really into it. So it's something that you should think is gross, but you don't. And I love that. And I think that's going to fly over the heads of a lot of people.
What did you make of that whole vault sequence, Brad?
I love the vault sequence. I that's something that I had been excited for people to see ever since they showed the first act to me at Pixar back at the end of March, because Bloofy and Lance Lashblade are two great characters, and I kind of wish that they got to go like with the core emotions throughout the rest of the adventure, because I feel like it might have added a more fun dynamic to what was happening. But yeah, those are absolutely great characters, and I love the callback to Pouchy coming back at the end, and like just how aggressive anger reaches into his mouth to grab the dynamite.
Yeah, like deeply disturbing imagery right there.
The Bloofy and Pouchy character too, like, really made me happy, because people have been pointing out, okay, so it's like a blue dog that's obviously Blue's Clues, but it's also talking to the audience, so that's very Dora the Explorer. But what it also is Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, which is another like thing with like, that's why you get the options of what's in the pouch. That's a Mickey Mouse Clubhouse thing. So I also think it's very cute, because Pixar's doing kind of a nod to their parent company and kind of mocking them at the same time, which is great, but people are so distracted by the obvious ones that they're missing the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse read, which I love.
I wanted to take a minute and give us some space to just mention like any little jokes or little moments or anything like that that we really appreciated. Like I was kind of alluding to this earlier, but there's that moment where or that whole scene where Anxiety is encouraging the different parts of Riley's imagination to imagine these kind of like worst case scenario situations, and there's one of the little bits up on the screen as like, you know, number 87 or something is Riley she's on the ice and she has fallen and her tongue has gotten stuck to the ice somehow. And then she's just like this terrified look on her face. Brad, I think there was one that you wrote about on the site about that was just like an Easter egg about a reference to a Sesame Street character.
Yeah, this is just a little thing. So one of the things that director Kelsey Mann talked about during the press conference at Pixar Animation Studios was that he's been a longtime fan of Sesame Street and the Muppets. And for those that you don't remember, both Frank Oz and Dave Goles have bit parts in the first Inside Out. They play two of the subconscious guards who, like, they get into like a little argument about whose hat is whose. And Frank Oz is famously, obviously, the voice of Yoda in the Star Wars saga, but he's also the voice of Muppets like Ms. Piggy and Fozzie. And Dave Goles is the voice of Gonzo and Dr. Benson Honeydew and other Muppet characters. And Kelsey Mann's a big fan of Muppets and Sesame Street. And one of them is also Carol Spinney, who is famously the person who was behind Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch. And he met Carol Spinney one time at a shopping mall. He randomly recognized him. And, like, you know, who out there is going to recognize Carol Spinney? Because you don't ever see Carol Spinney.
I would have.
Yeah. So. You know, so, and so he, like, went and talked to him and met him. And he said he was just a really kind man and everything. Unfortunately, Carol Spinney passed away. And so even though they were able to bring back Frank Oz and Dave Goles as mind cops in Inside Out 2 again, Kelsey Mann would have loved to have given Carol Spinney a cameo, but what they did instead is they made a little tribute to him in the form of a place called Spinney's Pizza. And the logo of the pizza place does have like the likeness of Carol Spinney and like his goatee and whatnot on a pizza slice. But unfortunately, the initial tribute they had was in a scene that got cut from the movie. After the championship game in the beginning, the girls were supposed to go to a pizza place, and that was going to be Spinney's Pizza. You would have actually seen the restaurant and everything. So what they did is they repurposed the pizza place so that you still see remnants of it when Riley is hanging out with the Firehawks in like a common area at hockey camp. And if you look at the pizza that's like on the tables, the boxes are from Spinney's Pizza. So that's the tribute they got in there to Carol Spinney.
That's cool. Were there any other like really subtle jokes or Easter eggs or anything like that that you noticed and wanted to call out?
Everything that Anhui does and says made me laugh out loud every single time, which like, because that's also such like a hyper specific teen girl emotion. Like, everybody has ennui, but when you are 13, especially like the summer between eighth grade and freshman year, this is also why Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade is a movie I love so much, because it captures that perfectly. But the every time Riley was doing something that like was totally against who she is, or it's like, I don't actually like that band. Yeah, it was the best time of my life. We had so much fun. I just wanted to like jump through the screen, and I was like, God, no, you're gonna regret this. Don't do this. Because yeah, we all do it. We all do it. I famously have talked about how the first review I ever did of Jennifer's Body back in 2009, which was a horrible time to be a woman working in horror, was like, believe it or not, but I really liked this movie. And like, that's all I could think about this entire time was like, Riley, no, no, don't embrace what you like. It's okay. So yeah, I love that. Not really a joke. I just, they nailed that experience and that feeling so hard.
Yeah.
There were two specific Easter eggs that I noticed. One of them, I did spot the traditional A113 Easter egg, which is something that is in every single Pixar movie. If you don't know what that is, just to make it short, it's basically that's the like the classroom number that when they were at when the Pixar originators were at Cal Arts, like that was the room that they were in. A lot. And so that number, letter number combination makes it into all Pixar movies in some form. And here you can see it in Roman numerals. It's the vault that the emotions get locked into. You can see it above the vault door. Nice. And then a fun one for people who love Bing Bong. If you look in the scene when we go into the emotions bedrooms just before the puberty alarm goes off, when you look at Joy's little sleeping area, if you look on her bookshelf, there's a little makeshift statue of Bing Bong and his flying rocket wagon. So she obviously has like a little memento that makes her think of Bing Bong.
Just keeping him alive.
Speaking of the vault stuff real quick, the deep dark shadow or the biggest shadow or a deep dark secret rather. Yes. That Riley has. Did you guys stay through the credits to see what that was?
Yes. I did.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed by that. I thought that that was like too much setup for that to be the payoff at the end.
You know, I initially thought so, too. And I thought that it might come back in the end of the movie somehow and be significant to the story. But when you see what happens in the post credits, and if you didn't, the reveal is that Riley apparently burnt a hole in a rug at one point. And that's something that she's very scared of anybody knowing. But I actually liked it because it's like this little thing that like that's what a kid would worry about. Like, oh, no, I don't want my parents to ever find out that I did this because I'll be in so much trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah, I think it's very cute for it to be that, especially because, you know, towards the end, we also see, you know, Riley coming to terms with the everything about herself. Like she breaks something at a store and like puts it back on the shelf and walks away from it, which again is like a very little kid thing to do. But I will say I saw the movie with a bunch of press colleagues. Many of us were queer. And when it was like, she's got this big, deep, dark secret, and watching how she reacts to, you know, the cool girls on the hockey team.
Yeah.
All of us were like, I know what you are, and all of the boys you have crushes on are super femme. Okay, sure. Yeah. Okay, Riley. We'll see what they let you do when you turn 16.
Yeah, Inside Out 3. Yeah. Okay, let's take a break real quick, and then we'll come back and talk about the ending of the movie.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So I wanted to talk to you guys about the anxiety attack. This is the part of the movie, most of the time, you know, I was laughing throughout here and there, maybe not quite as much as the first movie, but then I wasn't like super emotional. Like the Bing Bong moment in the first film, that comes whatever, 2/3 of the way through or something. It just like completely wrecked me. And then this movie, I was kind of like, I was open to it. I wanted to feel, you know, all of the emotions and really, I don't know, cry my way through this movie. And I didn't really feel that until the very end, but I thought the anxiety attack was incredibly powerful. And especially the moment, like sort of the transition out of that and into where Joy is being called back to the control panel, basically, and Riley has that warmth on her face and the music is swelling, and it was just all like super powerful. I was wondering if that hit you guys as hard as it hit me.
Oh, I almost barfed. I'll just like say that. So when Joy makes the comment about 2/3 of the way through that, like, maybe when you get older, you have less joy. It made me cry. Like, it broke the floodgates opened, and I was just kind of like a constant trickle throughout the rest of the ending. When the anxiety attack happens, it was twofold. One, watching Riley have an anxiety attack almost gave me an anxiety attack, because I know what that feels like of being that young, being in like a competitive place where you have to like get your shit together and do the best you can do, because this is going to affect your future, and your body is like, nope, and like there's nothing you can do to stop it. So that like hit me really hard. But it's especially when they're trying to get through to anxiety and Joy finally breaks through this, you know, tornado of orange, and her hands are stuck on it and she cannot let go, because that is also such an anxiety thing of like, I can do all of like the grounding techniques and check in with my senses and do my breathing exercises. I can do everything I know I'm supposed to do. But if I'm in the middle of an anxiety attack, I'm in the middle of an anxiety attack, and it has to ride out. And to see that personified of like, you're not doing anything wrong by not being able to stop this. You kind of just have to let it happen. Like, I was destroyed. Crying so hard, I was dry heaving, I was like fogging up my glasses, and I had my mask on, I'm choking in my mask. It was a problem. I was a disaster.
What about you, Brad?
Yeah, for me, you know, that's I don't think that I got quite as choked up as I did in the first one. You know, something about that first one just hits a little bit different, but this one, the ending definitely did it for me. Just seeing all the emotions together and seeing, you know, anxiety, you know, have that realization, and just the panic attack was done just like you said, you know, so well. It feels realistic. It's one of the best depictions of that there's ever been, you know, in a movie that's intended for kids. You know, I think just before that, Puss in Boots: The Last Wish did that, and there was actually a whole like discourse online about, you know, how important and how well done that was. And so yeah, I really like that. And for a little while after I'd seen the first one again more recently, I was wondering like if it would ever get to a point when like the emotions wouldn't necessarily be the ones controlling Riley, because at some point you have to like think, well, the emotions shouldn't be the ones who are in control of Riley's mind. At some point Riley's mind has to be like, she has to be in control of herself, and doing that at the end of this movie by having the console calling to Joy, you know, like really like starts this stepping stone of Riley starting to be in control of her own emotions, and like knowing what she's feeling and when she, you know, wants to feel something, and really just like getting a grasp on who she is. And I really like that development at the end of this one.
Yeah, that's well said. Yeah. I think it kind of, I appreciate and understand what you're talking about there, Brad, but like ultimately I kind of felt like this movie's message, which is all about how we are a collection of all of our experiences and emotions, and the way to establish your true self is to embrace every part of yourself, like that to me just wasn't quite as powerful as the message of the first movie, which was specifically about how it's not only okay, but it's actually healthy to embrace sadness, which is an emotion that our culture encourages us to repress. I personally thought that this movie's message just wasn't quite as focused as the first movie, so it wasn't as powerful, it wasn't as moving to me, I guess emotionally, as the first movie's was, but because it almost feels like, yeah, we've kind of learned this lesson a little bit before. It's just like a broader version of a lesson that we learned the previous time.
Well, for me too, like, I mean, well, one, puberty is messy, like extremely messy. And I love that they personify it by having them bring in the console, breaking things, and then never coming back to fix it. Hilarious. but for me, it's not just like the anxiety attack and that big moment, but also when they are putting back together Riley's sense of self, the way that the core emotions are able to get back to headquarters is by riding a flood of bad memories, of bad experiences, of things that they have shot to the back of Riley's mind. And, you know, we're not going to think about that. And it's forcing that all to come back, like the flood of everything that you've ever done wrong, and having to accept that that is also part of your core belief system. That is also part of who you are as a person, and like not running from that stuff. That to me was the infinitely more important message, is like letting those parts also be part of who you are, because stifling it and shoving it down and shoving it into the back of your mind is not healthy for anyone. Because all the things that like Riley does quote unquote wrong in this movie when anxiety takes over are all lessons that she could have learned if she hadn't shoved them into the back of her mind. If they were part of her core being, anxiety wouldn't have had to go into overtime because she already would have learned these lessons. So like that, like it like rocked me, like rocked me. Because I've been through a lot of shit in my life and a lot of trauma that I don't like to think about. But I have really spent the last like 6 years or so coming to peace with that. And I am so much more emotionally healthy coming to peace with like, yeah, this is a horrible bad thing that happened, but it is part of me. And it is part of like how I got to where I am. And it's okay for that to be part of my story. That doesn't like make me a bad person. It's just part of me. I was this whole movie, like that last third, I was like, I can't wait for therapy on Friday and talk about this. It's gonna be great.
All right, so I guess one of the last questions I have for you both, do you think this is like Pixar's big return? Is Pixar officially back now after, you know, there's been so much conversation, and we've had a lot of these conversations on the podcast itself over the years, of like since the beginning of the pandemic, the way that Disney has treated Pixar and like trained audiences to stay at home and all of this, like the movie seems to be doing pretty well. I have not looked at the most recent box office numbers as we record this on Friday, but it seems to be performing pretty well. Like, do you think creatively, financially, culturally, Pixar is like officially back now? BJ, what do you think?
It's difficult because part of me wants to say like, yeah, we're so back. But I think that this is a difficult movie to prove that with, because it is still existing IP. So is it that Pixar is back, or is it that Inside Out is back? Like, that becomes a difficult conversation. But at the same time, Elemental made a crap load of money. It just didn't make it in its opening weekend. And people like still keep forgetting that when they say things like Inside Out's the most successful movie. It's like, Elemental was one of the top 10 highest grossing movies last year. It just had legs. So it's hard for me to tell. I do think that there will always be people who, I don't think that it's necessarily they've been trained to wait for streaming. I think there is part of that. But also, like, going to the movies when you have a family and when you have children is so expensive. It is prohibitively expensive in a lot of places. And so I think it's less like, oh, we've trained audiences to do that, and more like audiences are taking the most cost-effective option. If you present people with a cost-effective option, they're going to take it 9 times out of 10. So unless theaters can combat the cost-effective option, that's what's going to prevail always. But you know, these are beloved characters that a lot of kids really, really like. So they probably are going to come out for it because they really want to see these characters specifically. Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Brad?
Yeah, you know, I mean, like BJ said, Elemental was big, and a lot of people forget that just because the early, you know, weekend box office numbers were not huge. And I think we're starting to see that some movies just need time for like some audiences to get around to seeing them. And if movies take a little longer to get to streaming, then I think that we, you know, start seeing that people will go see them in theaters again because they don't want to wait much longer. And for me, I think that, like, if anything, this is a big return just because it feels like it's a little more in line from what you expect. And some of that is because they released stuff straight to Disney Plus, but those movies that were released to Disney Plus were also great. Turning Red and Soul are fantastic. I enjoy Luca. You know, Disney's return to theaters was supposed to be Lightyear, and it stumbled a bit, you know? And so for me, you know, it's just kind of another, you know, great movie from Pixar. If anything, the one thing I would be a little worried about is that if this movie does turn out to be a big theatrical hit for Disney, that they might take the wrong lessons and think that they really do need to get lean back into like sequel territory just because it's Inside Out 2. When really, I think it's just Inside Out, the original movie was such a fantastic film that people immediately want to see what happens next, you know, and it's such an easy, relatable hook of like, oh, of course there's new emotions. Of course things are going to get crazy when Riley hits puberty, you know? And I think that you can keep this franchise going for a long time, you know? There's plenty of stories to tell with Riley in high school, you know? Because eventually you'd have to get around to the idea of Riley having some kind of romantic relationship, her first boyfriend, or, you know, or maybe her first girlfriend, her first date, you know, anything like that. Even though they did do a thing where, like, it was Riley's quote-unquote first date with an animated short, but it wasn't exactly the same as it would be, you know, if it were someone who was like a teenager. And you could even do this, like, with Riley going to college and becoming an adult and getting a job and all these things. You know, I would absolutely love to see, you know, the franchise continue like that. So I hope that it just does well, because I want to see good movies continue to be made and be rewarded by people seeing them in theaters where they should be seen.
Yeah, totally. I was looking ahead, and the next Pixar movie is Elio, which is coming out next year. And that's another original movie. I was not crazy about the trailer for that, but I'm really hoping that the director, Adrian Molina, who co-directed Coco, will be able to surprise me with that one. So fingers crossed for the future of Pixar. And then I think there's Toy Story 5 in 2026 is the current schedule for upcoming Pixar stuff. So, all right. Any closing thoughts about Inside Out 2 that we didn't touch on? Any moments that you wanted to highlight or anything at all? BJ?
The one other thing, well, one, Pouchy forever, Pouchy, our Lord and Savior. I weirdly love the sort of companion crushes that the emotions have on what feels like their natural other in this, sadness and embarrassment, fear and anxiety. There's like a little bit of like cute bestie frenemy stuff going on with envy and disgust. Really loved that. I thought it was a very cute touch of showing how there's, you know, there are emotions that are similar but different, and they work well together. I thought that was very, very cute. I like that a lot.
Shout out to Nostalgia for popping up for
June Squibb, you icon. Yeah,
a couple brief bits. It was nice that they had her pop up, and they're like, no, we're not. You're not ready for that yet. So you got some time to wait before you come around.
Yeah. I hate to end on a down note, but I was kind of bummed to watch this movie and not have the voices of Bill Hader and Mindy Kaling in my ears again. Like, they were so good in that first movie. And like, this time, like, Disney, what are you doing? Just pay them to come back. What on earth would possess you to move forward without paying them whatever they were asking for, considering how successful the first movie was and how many people were like excited about this one. It's just kind of a baffling decision.
I will say that I do think Tony Hale was a great replacement for Bill Hader. As much as I would have loved Bill Hader to like be paid what he deserves to be paid. Liza LaPira, on the other hand, I feel like that one felt like it was a little bit of a downgrade, because there was something about her delivery that wasn't nearly as like pointed as Mindy Kaling's voice was. Yeah. It just didn't feel like it like had the same punch that Mindy Kaling brought with her voice. She just has a very unique way of saying things and making them just hit that sharply.
Yeah. I also really love Io Edebiri, but she plays Envy in this movie, and like I didn't really think that was the appropriate emotion a lot of times. Like, she's good as the character, but it just kind of seemed like the moments where she takes over the console of Riley's mind, like, it's not really envious moments a lot of the time. So I don't know. I felt like they could.
So there's a difference between envy and jealousy is the thing. And like, this is very much envy. Like, jealousy, I think, is that emotion, but negative. Envy is that emotion, but like kind of gushy, if that makes sense. So I think she nailed it in that regard, because her form of envy is like, wow, you're so cool. Wow. And not like, I wish I had that, which is jealousy. Yeah. Like, they're two. Yeah. They're two different emotions.
And okay. Initially, I thought the same thing that Ben did. But then, like, what I ended up liking about Envy was that Envy really fed into anxiety. And so, like, having her be, like, a secondhand man, like basically, like, the little guy that's always like, yeah, Muggsy, get him. Yeah, yeah. You know, like, Envy was kind of like, guy. Yeah. Envy was, like, basically, like, the one, like, oh, my gosh, yeah, like, we need to do this because, yeah, I want to have that. And so I enjoy that. And it's funny that you mention, you know, jealousy as well, because there's an article that's, I don't know if it's on Slash Film or it's going to be on Slash Film this weekend. But initially, jealousy was one of the other new emotions that was considered for the movie. There were actually 9 total new emotions that were going to come in, because the whole concept was that they wanted to overwhelm Riley and headquarters with a bunch of new emotions that were hard to control. But it ended up just being a little too much, and it was unwieldy. And they also felt like they had a really hard time creating a distinction between jealousy and envy, because envy was also included in that lineup. And and they even had, there's concept art that you can see in the article where they had gags where the other emotions kept confusing envy and jealousy as twins. So like
I love that.
That was a pretty funny bit.
Okay, excellent. All right, well, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find much more about Inside Out 2 at slashfilm.com. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features that you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.